the way I like to do this presentation, especially for a group like you guys, is to have it be more interactive, less of me talking at you and telling you, here are the cybersecurity regulations, and more of a, here is what I found when I had conversations with members of your community, a little bit of the quantitative analysis that I ran, and then invite you guys to discuss it. And why do I want to invite you guys to discuss it? Well, part of the reason is just because it's fun and interesting. But more importantly, this is not definitive, okay, full stop research. This is an ongoing project. As you all know, the information technology and information security community changes, and it changes very, very rapidly. The last of my interviews was concluded, I think, about 2.5 years ago. It's an eternity in the time of our space. And I'm hoping that out of this dialogue will come an interest on the part of some of you to continue that. I am continuing the research and am hoping that some of you or your colleagues would be interested in having conversations with me going forward as part of that research. I'm happy to talk more about what that would mean. So Tim said a little bit about me as by way of background. The one notable thing is that I am both an attorney, please don't hold that against me, and a computer scientist. The reason for that is to be able to do exactly work like this, bridging the gap between understanding how information technology works in practice and how law and regulation, on the other hand, influences that. What's the relationship? How do they influence one another? And in the case here, how do laws and regulatory practices drive what you guys have to do on the ground day to day? So I'm going to tell you a little bit about what I've learned so far. I will try not to talk more than a few minutes. You'll see me do this a few times to keep an eye on my time. And then spend the bulk of our time having a conversation about it. I have some relatively provocative quotes, which I'm going to show you from the first interviews, and hope that you guys will have questions. And if not, then I will ask you provocative questions, because as Tim mentioned, I teach for a living, so I have no problem asking provocative questions. Hopefully this will be an enjoyable discussion for all of us. I was very interested, starting back in 2007, in learning about why was it the case that we have all these kinds of breaches happening. I'm not going to talk to you guys about these. You know about these. Other audiences I tell about these. What you will be interested in is how we went about trying to figure it out. And the way we did that was to sit down and say, as a first order matter, we need to have conversations, conversational interviews with people in key positions who are going to tell us what are the issues that matter. How did we do this? We recruited a small set of key, for our first round of interviews, chief information security officers. There are about 10 of them at large organizations. I can't identify the organizations. That's part of the human subjects protocol to protect anonymity. But it's who you'd expect we'd talk to. And had them tell us, what are the regulations? What are the laws that are affecting your life, that are changing the way you do your job on a day-to-day basis? And tell us how they affect it. Tell us how it affects your role in the organization. Tell us how it affects the technology you use and how it affects the technical practices. The conversations we had like this were fascinating. And the reason they were fascinating is because instead of a survey instrument, raise your hand if you've ever gotten a survey instrument emailed to you. If you're not, I'm not entirely sure. I believe the people who did not raise their hand. Maybe you haven't, but I get 20 of these a day. To the extent that the response bias doesn't make the data invalid anyway, they're not terribly useful. Why? Because raise your hand if you've ever felt when you're answering those questions one of those moments of, this question is not worded correctly. Well, that's what we wanted to get around, and my research collaborators and I, instead of doing that, we did have a script, but the script was designed to promote a conversation. And it was fascinating because the lawyer's side of us, I mentioned, unfortunately, I'm also a lawyer. I get to make lawyer jokes at this audience. I love it. Disclosure, I am a law professor. So, but the lawyers' side of our research group had this set of ideas of what were the laws that affected what people did on a day-to-day basis. And we had this list, and it included HIPAA and Gramm-Leach-Bliley, the state data breach notification laws. Sarbanes-Oxley was at the top of our list. Some of the sector-specific regulation, and some others. Coming out of the interviews, we knew the story was different. Some of those played a key role, and I'll talk about them. But we found out, for example, nobody cared about Sarbanes-Oxley. I mean, they cared about it as a checkbox, but it didn't affect practices. It didn't affect technological changes, except in very, very few corner cases, which I'm sure there's some folks in the room, and I'm happy to talk with the folks in the room about it. But in the vast majority of organizations, including nonprofit and government sector organizations, which are not, or public organizations, which are not federal government, this just wasn't on the radar map as something that changed it. Not so with HIPAA, not so with Gramm-Leach-Bliley, although that's sort of a separate thing for the financial space. And then the state data breach notification laws were the thing. Based on this information, we wanted to learn something, not just on a small qualitative set of what's going on, but conduct quantitative analysis to validate our intuitions about the impact, with the end goal being to be able to go to policymakers and say to them, "Hi, this is what's actually happening with these laws. I'm not a random professor who has an opinion. I'm not somebody from an industry group that has an agenda. I'm not somebody from a lobbying organization. I have real empirical data." And this past summer, I had the privilege of being able to actually take that data, which was derived from conversations with your colleagues and analysis on a set of breach incidents data from 2000 to 2010, which I'll talk about a little bit, and tell Congress what they didn't know about that in an effort to have them not pass a very bad, I shouldn't say very bad, but what would have been at least an inefficient and I think probably the wrong federal breach notification law. And it was really, really interesting to be up there testifying about that because nobody else was presenting this kind of data. And there were a lot of errors in what was being presented because, as many of you know, in information security, we work far too much off of anecdote and far too little off of empirically validated data in not the what most people call the classic computer science sense, where you do some form of analysis or logical theory, whatever the case is. That's important. I'm in no way suggesting it's not. But the empirical collection of systems and incidents data to form hypotheses about, form and test hypotheses about what is happening in the world in practice. Okay, so given that, what did I find? Well, I found that there are generally two categories of, I'll just call them laws for this audience. If you want to know the fine distinctions of how they work legally, I'm happy to discuss that. But two categories of law that were at play. One is what I call directive legislation. It's the do X model. So this is the rule or regulation or law that says thou shalt implement AES 128. By the way, that's a really, really bad law to write. If you're going to even think about writing a law like that, at least have the sense to do it by reference and say, use the current encryption model approved by the Central Security Service of the National Security Agency for Sweetbeat Cryptography or NIST Special Publication, whatever it turns out to be at that time. Don't ever encode a technical standard into a law. Really, really bad idea. Shockingly, I'm not pulling this out of nowhere. Massachusetts almost did that with AES 128 as part of their data security standards for protection of personal information of residents of the Commonwealth. Don't ask me why. Well, I actually know why they did that. Ask me afterwards. I'm not going to say it in this presentation. The second is what I call management-based regulatory delegation. What the heck does that mouthful mean? Well, you don't need to remember the name. Here's what you do need, or here's what is useful to remember. What is useful to remember is that instead of saying do X, This form of regulation, which is highly flexible and works very well with heterogeneous industries, says, here is a list of aspirational goals in information security generally. You, regulated entity, and this was in the healthcare space, so you, a hospital system, or a pharmaceutical company, or a small solo practitioner, family practice in a town, you have to develop a plan to address those aspirational goals. You have to update your plan according to risk assessments on a periodic basis. And here's the really important point. Your regulatory obligation is only to follow your own plan. It's to have the plan, update it, and follow it. It's not to do X or Y or Z, or even worse, do A sub 1 through 526. And yes, I'm sure there are regulators out there that would like to take that approach. Why does this matter? Well, what this does is it provides a degree of flexibility. It allows organizations in heterogeneous environments. It is probably obvious to everyone in this room the difference between the large hospital system and what challenges it faces from an information management and an information security perspective, and the small doctor's office, 50% of the records of which are paper, if not 100%. Very, very different challenges that they face, and then everybody in between. Okay. So we have these two categories. One of the questions I wanted to ask is, how effective were they at achieving various goals? And the metric for efficacy I used was preventing breaches. Now, I realize, and many of the people in this room do, that that is at best a weak metric, but it's a weak metric for something important. It's a weak metric for, are you doing security at all? If you're doing no security, or if you're doing very, very poor security, the probability of experiencing a reportable data breach is much higher. So that's the metric against which I tested it. First of all, what is a reportable data breach? Well, 46 states and 5 other U.S. jurisdictions, yes, that amounts to 50, but not all 50 states have these laws, have laws of this flavor where you have to report a certain type of breach of personal information. And I'll break this down for you very quickly because these are look like they're highly complex and they're really not. I tried to tell Congress that this summer. They might have believed me. You have some type of an identifier. It's usually a name. It's combined with some type of sensitive person information, which is either usually a Social Security number, some type of financial account number, or a government-issued ID number like your driver's license. If you have both of those together and it's not encrypted and it's released outside of your control, you have a reportable breach. That is what all those laws say. They don't say if you have somebody's name and phone number, you have to go and send out 26,000 letters. And while it's true there are differences among the states and jurisdictions in how they implement this, the differences are very, very small. And as I told Congress this summer, I could do these in my sleep. It takes me about an hour if someone comes to me to put together all of the letters. And I could write a computer program. And if I told you guys the parameters, many of you probably could write a computer program in about a day that would, if I gave you the proper legal language, that would generate all the notices. This is not a complex regime. But it does generate breach reports. Why does that matter? Because it gives us the empirical data off of which to test efficacy. But first we have this question, because they're state laws, right? Well, guess what? They weren't all passed at the same time. Shocker. The states did things all on their own, all at different times, and just expect interstate businesses or states that handle data across states, which is pretty much every company that has any kind of an information technology presence now, to figure out how to comply. So how did I figure out when people first became aware of and when there was sort of a compliance saturation with this reporting? These are two important trends, or two important points in time, because they tell us when people started paying attention to these laws and trying to make changes, and when everybody, or mostly everybody, was trying to make changes. So when do we start trying to figure out, were some people better than others at complying? The way I did this for the quantitative analysis people in the room was to use something called polynomial regression to find inflection points. Happy to talk about that at greater length for those who are interested in questions or offline. But basically, I found 2 points. One, which is around summer of 2004-ish, which is when people began to become aware of the breach notification laws. And the other, which is late summer 2008, which is when people were essentially in full compliance. Why do we start this, by the way, is the polynomial regression of periodic breach incidents, number of breaches per month. And the reason that you see a drop-off after full compliance, that's the key point. Why is there a drop-off after full compliance? It's because people are incentivized, organizations are incentivized to stop breaches. This is not a story about a bunch of organizations that just want to run willy-nilly with their security and not do it. This is a story about people who genuinely want to actually try to prevent breaches. So they have an incentive to do that. So instead of comparing, because you can't compare the number of breaches between healthcare, which was previously subject to HIPAA before all these breach notification laws came in. You can't compare the number of breaches they experience and the number of breaches that finance experiences with the number of breaches that everybody else who is not subject to any regulation experience, because they're different targets. Finance is a pretty juicy target. That, I think, is probably obvious to everyone here. I learned in my conversations, my interviews with the healthcare folks, they're actually a very juicy target too. Does anyone here work for a healthcare organization? A couple of folks. You guys might know this. You're juicy targets. Why are you juicy targets? Medical insurance fraud is worth a lot of money. Medical data is apparently worth a lot of money. And you have data that is very, very useful for identity theft. Well, where did we go with this? This enabled me, we're going to ignore this part of it because it's more for the quantitative presentation. You see 2 lines up here. These are linear regressions after that time in 2008 I told you about, when just about everybody realized that there were these breach notification laws out there and were trying to take steps to reduce their reportable breaches. In other words, to improve their security to achieve the goal of not having that. Now, there's various ways to do it, and it might just be encrypt everything. It also might be harden your systems so nobody gets in, and it might be improve your business processes so there aren't lost laptops, lost hard copies, whatever. People can't walk into the building, whatever the case is. But this is what you're trying to reduce, and all of the measures to achieve it are, I would argue, security steps forward. So fast forward to this analysis. Rather than try to figure out who had more or less breaches, we looked at how far did people have to go from the high point to their low point. In other words, how much were you already doing? The steeper red curve you see here, this is everybody but healthcare and finance, the people who were not previously regulated by any information security law. They had a lot further to go. For those of you familiar with linear regressions, that has a slope nearly 4 times the blue line, which is healthcare and finance. Healthcare and finance had a lot further less to go. What does that mean? The translate takeaway point is they were already doing much better information security. When I say this colloquially and give presentations and such, to non-technical audiences, I will use the phrase nearly 4 times better. Some of you in the audience are probably thinking, well, it's healthcare and finance. They're juicy targets. It's probably more than 4 times better. You're probably right, but I can't empirically prove that, which is why I go with the 4 times better. So there's a takeaway here that this other style of regulation, healthcare and finance, remember I mentioned the 2 styles, these guys, both sets became subject to the Do X regulation. That's the, if you have an incident, report it unless it's encrypted. And as I'm going to show you in a moment, which will start leading into the discussion portion of the talk, the de facto effect of the do X, excuse me, the if you experience a breach, you have to report it, was to create this do X model where X was encrypt. So what people did was go and say, well, if we have to report unless it's encrypted, the answer is let's encrypt everything. Brings us to the first quote, which I'll leave up there for you guys to start talking about while I finish this out. So we know something about now the differences between how a flexible style of regulation works and a directive style of regulation works. The directive style of regulation is extremely effective at getting organizations to do this. Encrypt all the laptops. There's another quote, let's see, where is it? If it moves, encrypt it. If it stays there, encrypt it. It's very effective at getting that to happen. It doesn't do anything else. The flexible regulation put organizations in a position where they were already doing comprehensive information security better. I say better, not well, because I have no data on whether or not they were doing it well, and I don't pertain to, but they were doing it better. The reason they were doing it better, I ask you just to believe me, but we'll go into the quantitative data during the Q&A if you want. They were doing it better because they had less far to go as they tried to reduce the number of breaches. As you all know, it's impossible to prevent all breaches. So the shorter the distance you go in reducing it, the less distance you had to go toward reaching that point where you were mitigating it as much as is practicable. What I have up here are a series of quotes about what I learned from the interviews, what my research team learned. And as you've probably guessed, one of the things that we learned was that the breach notification laws, the do X, was very effective at getting people to encrypt everything. Many of you, I'm sure, have encountered this in your professional work. Another quote. Now, this is interesting. It reversed the whole direction security was taking from when they started this job. The context of this quote was before that. This chief information security officer was doing their own risk assessment of what were the most salient risks, not pursuant necessarily to HIPAA, although they had to do that also, but deploying resources according to what they thought was the most appropriate. This quote, contextualized, also tells, this CISO also said, now I've got my chief executive, chief operations officer breathing down my neck, saying spend your budget on encrypting all the laptops. Raise your hand if you think that chief information security officer got more budget to encrypt all the laptops when that directive came down. You see where this goes, right? Okay. And this quote explains it in detail. And I'll come back to this in a second. I just want to see if I left any more in. No, that's all I left in there. So what I want to do with you guys now, I'm going to leave this one up to start. What I want to do with you guys now, normally I would come down in front and have much more of a conversational style, but I've been told I have to stay within sight of the camera or my host will throw things at me and otherwise heckle me. What I want to do is have a conversation with you guys. I want to hear what your thoughts are on what I have presented so far, what you'd like to know more about from my interviews, and what questions or thoughts you would share. So I'm going to officially start the Q&A now and hope that some of you will come up and just get right into it. But I do teach for a living, so if not, I will throw things out. And we do have someone starting off right away. Great.
Are we on? Garrett Wallman, MIT.
Can you speak up just a little bit?
Garrett Wallman from MIT. So I'm sort of curious, all these laws and rules and regulations that say, go encrypt your data, how badly are they written in terms of allowing people to do something that looks like crypto but doesn't actually protect their data?
This is a great question. Okay. Now, first of all, it's important to stress that it doesn't say go encrypt. It says, if you experience a breach and you're not encrypted, then you have to report. The de facto effect, again from the interviews, is that everybody treated it as a go encrypt, which is why I call it directive regulation, although what it really is disclosure-based regulation. So it's just a distinction I want to draw for you. That's more of a distinction that legal scholars care about and you guys don't need to worry about, with one caveat. Your legal office at your organization could decide we're going to mitigate risk differently, and we're going to mitigate risk, for example, by insuring against breaches, which would move the focus away from this type of an approach. Cyber insurance is in its infancy, doesn't work very well yet. I have some other research going on with that. But I want to point that out to you because in the course of the next 5 years, this may change. Now, on to your question. Terrible. Awful. It uses language like renders unreadable. I can't comment on that. Some of them say renders unusable. That might have a tiny bit more teeth to it, but unusable to whom? Unusable to the layperson? A 5-character Caesar cipher would achieve that. Renders unusable to me? AES with no bugs in it. Otherwise, I pretty much own it. There's some Blowfish implementations and others that work too, but you know, AES is really what you should be using with proper implementation. Or maybe a better way of saying it is NSA Suite B approved cryptographic implementations. That does not appear anywhere in any of the language of any of the state statutes. And one of my favorite anecdotes from private practice is when a client came and said, and really, really wanted to push, and the partner who was selling services had to, was trying to push this too, and myself and the other technical associate, or associate with a technical background, were sort of like, no. The client had an algorithm, and it was an encryption algorithm, it was proprietary. Yeah, you're all chuckling at that already anyway. Well, in theory, it could be proprietary, that's good, right? Ask me how many bits the encryption key was. Just take a guess. No, really, someone take a guess. Throw out a number.
Was it more than 100?
You're all overestimating. 32-bit proprietary encryption, and they wanted, how many seconds on this device? And they wanted to claim that that was sufficient for the purposes of the statute. Here's the real kicker. There is no case law, no attorney general opinions, that's the equivalent of like NIST or Health and Human Services or one of the financial regulators issuing an opinion, an advisory opinion. The attorney generals do it for the states for the most part. There are no opinions out there at all on this. California's legislature recently revised their law a little bit to get better, but everybody is out to lunch. Most people in this room have some type of technical background of some form and probably understand the idea of a reference in programming, where instead of hard coding the answer into a particular portion of your program, you reference another part of your program. Lawmakers do not understand this. Now, that said, there are some people who are starting to talk about concepts called regulating by reference. It would have been very easy to say in these laws, encrypted in a way that is compliant with NIST special publication, or whatever the current NIST standard is. To my knowledge, with the exception of a few Department of Defense standards, some efforts in HIPAA, but health insurance, the Health and Human Services implementation of the HIPAA security rule, and I believe there's one random exception in the IRS information security rules of all things. But basically, it's not anywhere to be found. Okay. Other questions people have in sort of the general question format?
Eric Smith from TechSoft. One question, you're talking, your research is on the demand side, i.e. after the fact, company has implemented this thing and then they get attacked. Do you have any research on the supply side, on the programmers and then developers and the software houses that are producing the products and how, what their requirements are?
So not in this iteration of the research. This is actually something I'd love to do. So as part of the next iteration of the research, in addition to any of you who work on Eric. What Eric has called the demand side, i.e. the data custodians, those who hold and process the data. I'd love to talk to you. I would also love to talk to those who produce the systems. That is something that we want for the next side. Now, some of the organizations that I interviewed were both. You know, I interviewed the organizations, the CISOs of the organizations you'd expect me to interview, but I interviewed the demand side CISOs. So that's where the focus was at the time. We did get a little bit, what you're calling the supply side or the custodian, what I would call the custodian side CISOs. They did give us a little info on it, but that is something I want to make a component. This includes security vendors. It includes basic IT systems vendors. Basically, anybody who makes an information system or a component of an information system, that includes hardware as well. And one of the things in which I'm particularly interested is talking about the degree to which we should be thinking about certification with a lowercase c of information systems. And that doesn't necessarily mean certification like meeting a standard. It might mean borrowing from the civil engineering model, where there has to be a supervising licensed professional engineer. How many people in here are licensed professional engineers of any type? Wow, we have one in the room. Are you a civil engineer? I'm just curious, what is your licensure? We have a licensed electrical engineer, which is, by the way, the closest to a computer scientist of the current set of licensures, unless they fixed it in the past 2 years. I haven't looked at it. What? Apparently they haven't. We do not have this in computer science and information systems. Why does that concern me? That concerns me because we do a lot of high reliability things with systems. So that should be part of the discussion. Don't know if it's a good idea, but that should be part of the discussion. And for those of you who are willing to talk to me, whether completely informally and off the record, all the way up to being an anonymous interview subject protected by a human subjects protocol, where I'm the only person who knows who said what, well, myself and my research team, I would love to hear your comments. And we do, of course, as you saw from the quotes, we protect this data with very, very strict protocols.
Rick Farrow. So you've talked mostly about the directive regulation and its lack of real effect in many cases. We will encrypt everything. What about the more flexible forms like HIPAA? How is that really different? Can you give us examples?
So we know two things about HIPAA from my empirical research to date. This is, again, from the interviews and from the quantitative analysis. And this is a large part of why I'm reaching out to the community again to say, I'd like to do more of these interviews, these conversations, because there's important things for you to tell us, the researchers. We know two things. First of all, we know that it makes organizations' practices more resilient, at least against what we call data breaches. So I translate to at least they are substantially better at some of information security than those not subject to it at all. There still are breaches out there. You read about healthcare breaches of the various hospital systems, the pharmacies, the pharmaceutical manufacturers, and you think, well, how can they be better at it? Well, this quantitative data shows, counterintuitively to what the press tells you, that they are at least somewhat better at it. Many of them still have places to go. Now, what's interesting is if you look at all, and I really mean all, of the major breaches you read about in the press, or if you were to go to the Department of Health and Human Services website, hhs.gov, and look for their HIPAA stuff where they list off all the HIPAA enforcement actions, I believe every single one of those organizations did not have a security plan, which meant they were out of compliance with the law. So the people who were doing bad security didn't comply with the law and then do bad security, i.e. they didn't have a plan and have the plan failed. They had no plan at all. And that was in large part why Health and Human Services chose to pick on them, because they had no plan. Now, what else do we know? Well, from the interviews, and again, preliminary interviews, designed to tell us more what should we be thinking about than comprehensively what are the effects. So that's an important qualifier, but with that qualifier, what we know, or what we have been told, is that these organizations were incentivized and driven, however you want to phrase it, to think more about information security as a holistic exercise because they had to develop a plan. And I can tell you from my private practice experience, I used to be an attorney in private practice with a large, very, very large international law firm that had a huge practice for this. And I used to do this kind of work, developing these compliance plans in conjunction with accounting and auditing firms. We'd go in, we'd do security assessments of large organizations. I can tell you that organizations on the other side of one of these assessments, i.e. organizations that developed plans, they also thought much more holistically about what does information security mean. And I want to highlight that holistic point because it's important. How many people would say that the term cybersecurity is what you hear more often nowadays? Just raise your hand if you feel you're in that category. Here's the problem with the term cybersecurity outside of this room and this community. People hear it and they think technology. They think numbers on a screen. I need to make a slide for this presentation. That is a non-trivial part of our work. It's at most one-third. The regulators actually recognize this, the Federal Trade Commission, Health and Human Services, the financial regulators, and they divide it up into technical, but also administrative and physical security. Are there any, I assume there's a reason, are there any CISPs in the room? So the CISPs in the room probably remember this because it was on your exam. There are administrative measures. What are your organization's business processes for dealing with security? How do you ensure that someone doesn't have a yellow sticky with the password on their screen? How to ensure they lock their file cabinets if they contain sensitive information, like, I don't know, they're a sysadmin and there's a book with all the data on all the servers in their unlocked file cabinet. That, of course, that's never happened in any organization I know. And then physical security. Do you lock the doors to the building after 8 p.m.? Do you require people to wear a badge to get into sensitive areas? And then my favorite of all favorites, no, this is a real story from a client, is the server room locked at all? I don't even want to go there. I think we have time for one, maybe two more questions. Can we maybe go to the gentleman who hasn't had a chance to speak yet first, and then we'll try to do both of them?
Well, now I have two questions, but hopefully you can answer really quickly.
Try to go fast.
First is, for the solo organizations versus the large organizations, wouldn't the management-based laws...
Just call it flexible.
Yeah. Flexible ones boil down into the directive ones. So if I'm a solo doctor, I don't have time to think about HIPAA and stuff. I'm just going to hire a vendor or something and say, hey, make me HIPAA compliant, versus the large organizations that are going to say, okay, let's think about information security. And the second question is, have you compared how Europe does their regulations, and is it any different in terms of...
So I'll answer the second one first, which is not for this stage of the research. Yes, it is something that I'm working on right now with a professor from the University of Milan. He and I are collaborating on this. It's more about focusing on harmonizing the compliance process, because the EU system and our system have very, very different views of privacy at the normative level, which makes it hard to, and since that drives security, which is an objective exercise, I'd suggest to you, not a normative exercise, it makes it harder to do that kind of comparison. Okay, that said, your first question, which is very, very good. The answer is it's actually not that much of a concern. They might hire outside vendors, but HIPAA is flexible not just in terms of how do you do it differently for your organization because it faces different threats. One hospital faces different threats than another, or a hospital faces different threats than CVS. CVS faces different threats than Novartis. But it also scales to the size and capabilities of the organization as well. Meaning, the small solo family practitioner in my hometown, which is a small cow town, well, not cows anymore, but we had them when I was a kid. And we have subdivisions now. And five cows, literally five. That solo practitioner has, I don't want to say less to comply with, but they don't have to do the same degree of comprehension. And that's not, the regulations contemplate those differences. It was a very thoughtful exercise by Health and Human Services. I have another paper coming out which goes into in detail why this process worked so well as a regulatory matter. Much more of a law paper, but I can talk to some of you offline, and of course it's available on my website to read. We can very quickly, I think, do one last question.
Okay, this is actually pretty simple. You already mentioned it with respect to HIPAA, but do the other regulations have a similar structure for centralized reporting of breaches so that you can actually get this data reliably?
So actually, very few, if any, have centralized reporting. So this data here, this data is a result of what I call the not-so-open Security Foundation. And the reason I call them that is because through early 2011, they maintained this data set open and freely available to anyone who wanted to download it. And then they closed it. Now, I am working with them in good faith to try to get them to allow me to continue using it for academic research. If anyone knows folks there, I would be grateful if you would assist in that process. I think it is a misunderstanding between the two of us as to what my purposes are. And the fact that I do not intend to interfere with whatever theirs are. But it's a data set, basically, where it started out many years ago as a listserv for security that became something maintained by the Privacy Rights Clearinghouse, then taken over in an organized fashion by OSF for about 3 to 4 years they ran it, and they were great. And the reason they were so great is because somehow they got data not just after it made it into the papers, but before it made it into the papers. My anecdote, I was in private practice. I got a call. I was usually the third phone call. First phone call outside the organization when a breach happened. Had not been reported. Their internal security people knew about it, and their outside counsel, bound by attorney-client privilege, knew about it. 24 hours later, I went onto the database of the Open Security Foundation. The incident was there. To this day, I don't know how it got there. But their data is very, very good, and I describe it as all publicly known security breach incidents. By the way, the dots are the number per month. This is breaches per month. This is the time scale of month. So those are not individual incidents. It's a measure of the number at that given month. So going forward, I'm going to be working off of the Privacy Rights Clearinghouse data, but there is not very good centralized reporting. About 10 states require it. HIPAA sort of requires it. Other than that, and there's the Defense Department pockets and that kind of things, but there's no comprehensive centralized reporting. When I talked to Congress this summer, and again, part of the incentive for you guys is, why did I become both a computer scientist and an attorney? I want to be a conduit to the policymakers. So I think we are close to time. So thank you all very much. We'd be delighted to speak with anyone afterwards. And I encourage those of you who might like to speak with me anywhere in the range from completely informally to being part of the next round of research, please come and talk to me. I'd be delighted to hear your thoughts, your opinions, or those of anyone you'd like to introduce me to. Thank you very much.